notebook that we'll be working from for the next 4 days, and then the larger notebook is their governor's recommended budget. The department's budget is for House Bill 3057 is $351,750,981, 525 positions, and 485.46 FTE. The budget environment for the department, like many state agencies, is of increasing complexity. The new challenges, if approved by the legislature, will be integrating the Office of Emergency Management and Homeland Security into the department, addressing the state's emergency preparedness issues, addressing Homeland Security issues, helping to address the needs of returning National Guard soldiers and veterans. Continuing challenges are managing the increasing number and duration of federal and state deployments, recruiting and retention of soldiers and airmen, maintenance of installations, construction of new installations, the increasing volunteerism of the State Defense Force, and position reclassifications, with the last issue being addressing environmental and urban encroachment on its installations, especially those related to training. The department is a state and federal partnership, and so it receives two sources of funding. One is primarily direct federal funds it receives. So we can look at the department in two pieces. It receives direct federal funding outside of the department's state budget, and then it also, which is about $425 million and funds about 2,132 FTE. And then the federal funds that come in through primarily cooperative agreements and capital construction projects are those that are budgeted in the state's budget and under the purview of the legislature. The federal funds are used across the program to fund its six major program areas. The level of federal funding, however, varies by program and type of project and type of facility. The department does receive general fund support to pay wages and salaries of employees and has state matching funds for these various federal-state agreements, as well as to pay some debt service. General fund makes up approximately 6.8% of the proposed budget. Other funds make up approximately 28.51% of the proposed budget, with federal funds comprising the remaining 65% of the budget. The department's $352 million budget is $251 million, or 248%, greater than its 2005-07 legislatively approved budget of $101 million. The most significant reasons for this increase is the transfer of Office of Emergency Management from the State Police to the department for about $180.9 million, 40.88 FTE. Policy packages that are related to the department on the National Guard side of about $76.7 million, 13.5 FTE. And then there was also one reduction of one-time funding associated with the Veterans Assistance Package from last biennium of about $1.3 million. The budget does not include any reductions beyond those that are one-time in nature. The OEM policy package of the transfer includes four separate enhancements within that we can discuss throughout the course of the next few days. But each of the department's major program areas in administration, operations, now emergency management, community support, debt service, and capital construction under its proposed budget in this measure are enhanced. So the Legislative Fiscal Office will be developing its formal budget recommendations to present to the subcommittee after the department's 4-day public hearing and prior to its work session.
Thank you, Mr. Borden. And colleagues, I also wanted to let you know that on Tuesday of next week, we're going to be having an informational meeting on how we're doing on reintegrating our returning troops and also on the various needs, including mental health needs, post-traumatic stress disorder, et cetera. And that'll be on Tuesday of next week. So we're also going to have some public testimony. If there are some of your constituents, I would encourage you to to send them along. We'll be sending out a statement from my office. I'd be happy to get that to you if you'd like to use that to send out to your constituents as well. So with that, why don't we just let's get started. General Reese? I'm General Caldwell. Sorry.
The youth challenge has been here.
General Caldwell, before we get going, I wanted to recognize the young people in the audience who've done a remarkable job working in the Capitol today, and we appreciate your participation in this process. So we salute you and wanted to welcome you to the Capitol for your youth challenge.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director of the Oregon Military Department, and these young folks behind us, this is a pleasure for us to have them over here today. They represent our Oregon National Guard Youth Challenge Program that we're about 12, 13 years of operations now over in Bend, Oregon, and we have a little CD that we'd like to show you later as we move through this process, but these folks are going to be headed back to Bend here shortly, and I thought it would be a good idea for them to at least get a flavor for some of the process. They got to see the floor work today. They got to do the present the colors in both houses, and so we're delighted that they were received so well, and I think they've learned a great deal today, and then go back and talk to their other 115 folks that are over there and tell them what they learned. So we're delighted that they were able to make it. We're again with me today is on my left is Carl Jorgensen, who's our Director of Fiscal Administration, and on my right is Satish Chipadier, who is with the Department of Administrative Services. So we'll be able to answer any questions that you may have, hopefully. We're going to go through the slides. You're welcome to stop me at any time, and we'll try to give you a quick overview of our programs and our option and our policy option packages and the efficiencies that we've made within our budget. Oregon National Guard mission is to provide the citizens of the state of Oregon and the United States with a ready force of citizen soldiers and airmen equipped and trained to respond to any contingency, natural or man-made. When we're needed, we are there. The Oregon Military Department is home of the Oregon Army and Air National Guard, who in addition to recent deployments to Afghanistan and Iraq, have played a critical role in preparing for and responding to natural disasters here in Oregon and throughout the country. The National Guard is the governor's largest available organized and trained force for disaster response, protection of life and property, suppression of civil disorder, and support to law enforcement, and supporting first responders. The governor may call the National Guard to act in state status at his discretion. He is our commander-in-chief. This places our soldiers and airmen and over $2.8 billion in facilities and federal equipment assigned to the Oregon National Guard at the governor's disposal. Oregon Emergency Management, likewise, has its central role assisting local governments and state government to prevent, mitigate, and prepare for and respond to and recover from natural and man-made disasters. The unifications of these missions under the Oregon Military Department consolidates lines of responsibilities and communication with local and federal level, as well as with neighboring western states that already have homeland security and emergency preparedness oversight within their National Guard structures. We'll present the transition of the Oregon Military or the Oregon Emergency Management during our program option packages later in this presentation. And this might be a place for me to also add that there's a House Bill 2370 that is the instrument that does do that. It's been referred to this committee. There are a couple of amendments that we believe need to be added to it, and so in this committee, I assume we'll deal with that at work session either separately or more than likely separately, I would guess. But it is currently sitting in the House way, or in the Ways and Means process. It was referred from the Substantive Committee with a due pass recommendation to you. Our command chart, which we have up on the screen and also is before you, details how we're organized, an overview of our command structure, the Oregon Guard and its organization. It demonstrates our tremendous capability and the degree of difficulty associated with its, based on the variety of the missions that we perform for both the state and the federal government. Nearly every generation in Oregon history can attest to significant contributions of our citizen soldiers and airmen and their families that they have made in defense of our freedoms and the way we, our American life. long before September 11th, the Oregon National Guard, both at home and abroad, has served in great, or served this state and the nation in unparalleled levels. In the past 15 years, the Oregon Guard has contributed forces, equipment, and people to Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm, patrolled the no-fly zones of Operations Southern and Northern Watch, served in stabilization operations in Bosnia, performed as peacekeeping forces in the Sinai Desert, and many other missions in places around the world that are too lengthy to mention, but literally almost every country in the world where America has a presence, the Oregon National Guard has been in one capacity or another over the last decade. We've also maintained a state-to-state partnerships, responded to domestic emergencies, performed humanitarian security operations in the aftermath of the hurricanes on the Gulf Coast, and assisted numerous search and rescues here in Oregon and in other western states. We sent over 2,100 people to Louisiana after the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. We were able to mobilize those folks and have them on the ground within 48 hours of being notified of the need. We actually could have had them there quicker. Our first element was out in less than 12 hours and actually took up operations at the Louisiana, at the New Orleans airport within 12 hours of the time we were notified. We're pretty proud of that, and we think that also demonstrates what the capability is here in the continental United States for other states if we were to need them here in Oregon. The next series of slides will take us through the organization and some of the things we do throughout the state. These are the, I'd like to draw your attention to how we're organized again. These are major Air Guard facilities that we have on the map. And those facilities are Portland Air Base, the Camp Rialia, where we have a unit of the Air Guard, and then we have another fighter wing at Kingsley Field. Those primarily, next slides, we fly the F-15 Eagle at both Portland and Klamath Falls. Klamath Falls is a training base. Klamath Falls is designed to train both active duty and Air National Guard pilots. After they complete their initial training programs, then they come to Klamath Falls to learn how to fly the F-15 Eagle. We also have the 272nd Combat Communications Squadron, when their job is to communicate literally any place in the world, and they can set up at any place, any time, and they can run first-class communications capable of doing anything from cellular telephones to working with computers and making sure that we can communicate. The 116th Air Control Squadron is located at Camp Rialia. They have been one of the most heavily used Air Guard assets we have. They have been deployed all over the world. They just returned, about 50% of that unit just returned from Iraq about 3 months ago, and they conducted air control operations in right out of the Baghdad airport. The Army National Guard facility locations for the 41st Brigade, as you can see, pretty much go right down the Cascade Mountain Range. Their headquarters is in Tigard. This brigade is now has 951 people deployed to Afghanistan. The brigade in total is about 3,500 people as a full brigade combat team. It's light infantry. The next slide, and this couple of photos of the second of the 162nd Infantry soldier in Baghdad, and then also 41st Brigade soldier who was that photo actually was a worldwide photo, was taken by a photojournalist when they were deployed to Baghdad 2 years ago. You may recall that unit sustained significant combat casualties while they were deployed. It's one of the premier units that we have in this organization, and they have also been one of the, I suppose if you looked at everything we've done with respect to reintegration, this was the unit that it got started with. This is the unit that we've learned our lessons on. The next unit we'll show on the map is the 82nd Brigade, which consists of several units. The primary unit is the 3rd Battalion, 116th Cavalry, headquartered in Le Grand. It's a heavy tank battalion. You can see in the next slide that their main piece of equipment is the M1A1 Abrams battle tank. They deployed to Iraq. They were in Dukert, which is up north and near the Kurdish area. They sustained two deaths while they were there. Both were non-combat related. And they had a pretty good tour considering what they were faced with. We've also inside this brigade, we have the 82nd Brigade, we have the 1042nd Medical Company, or their air ambulance company. This is the one that you see on TV all the time on Mount Hood, rescuing people. These are the folks that go out on a daily basis. They We have 12 of these helicopters located here in Salem. This unit has been deployed to Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Iraq, Bosnia, and they're scheduled again to go back this next year. We're not certain of the dates. We're not certain of the requirement at this point. We're still working with the National Guard Bureau on that. Also in the brigade, we have the company of Chinooks, or a detachment of Chinooks in Pendleton. The Chinook helicopter CH-47 just returned from Afghanistan, where you may have recalled reading in the newspaper, and I know Senator Nelson's very much aware of it, where one of their helicopters was shot down and two of our soldiers were killed in that incident in Afghanistan. They are currently back refitting. We've just pushed our helicopters into rebuild. We're getting them back. I can tell you right now that, and we're going to discuss equipment as we move on through our process here later, but this is a good example of the lack of equipment that we're dealing with. This company should have six CH-47s. They currently have four flyable. They actually have five, but one of them is non-flyable. It would be a hangar queen, from what we would term it. And we actually should have, the original companies were 15, so a half a company would be seven or eight. The Army's cut back on the size of the companies, both in the UH-60 Blackhawk and also in the CH-47, because they're simply not available. They're not being manufactured fast enough to get them back into the play to replace the ones that have been battle damaged. So we're at a lesser capability in that group than we would like to be. I will tell you that both these helicopter units are extremely important to us, and with respect to wildland fires here in Oregon. Both of them fly extensively during the summer when we have fires, and the CH-47 is the workhorse that we appreciate the most because it can haul the most water. But with only three of them really available, it limits our capability to really help out in that regard. The next slide will show you, this is the whole composite of what our facilities and what our locations are. The red stars are unit training areas. We operate six training areas. We have one at Camp Rialia, 2,2500 acres, right on the Oregon coast, which is next to Warrenton. We have the Boardman Range that we use sporadically. We're working with the Navy, who owns that facility, to do some more training on that in the future. We have Umatilla Depot activity, the chemical depot, where we have a training relationship with the Army, who owns that. We have the BIAC Training Center down in Central Oregon, which is BLM land, and I might add that we just signed an agreement with them in December, I believe it was, to codify a long-term agreement we've had with them. We were only allowed five-year leases. We have a 20-year lease now with the BLM. We have a great relationship with the BLM, and we've become one of their favorite customers. To the point when we signed this agreement for the 75,000 acres or so that we're using on BLM land, BLM said you will take 35,000 additional acres that we frankly didn't want because it's not adjacent and it was a little bit problematic for us to move soldiers to it to do the training. But the reason they wanted us in there was because we rehabbed the area so well that we've been on for 25 years. And it changed the dynamics with respect to their wildlife that they said, no, if you want this bigger piece, you got to take this smaller piece in order for you to continue to do business with us because you guys do a good job of rehabbing the areas and helping the wildlife out. So we agreed and went ahead and did that. The rest of the green dots on this map are armories. And as you can see, we're pretty well smattered throughout. They're scattered throughout the state. In most major cities, we have an armory. And then the two air bases, and then the unit up at Camp Rialia. Next slide I want to show you is some of our community support and programs that we run. The first slide is a picture of our civil support team. Civil support team is located here in Salem. It's a 22-man organization, both Army and Air Guardsmen that are full-time. They work full-time. Their job is to respond after first responders find something that they're not familiar with. It could be chemical, could be nuclear, could be biological. This team has tremendous capability. It can come in and identify any substance, they have a mobile lab, they have mobile capabilities with respect to communications, telephone, satellite, you name it, these folks can do that. If this committee is interested, we'll provide an opportunity to bring the equipment down here or get you out to our location out on State Street where you can actually see what these people do. It's really impressive. This has been a great force multiplier for all first responder units, all fire departments, and any first responder unit in the state. They're very mobile, and we can, if we need be, we can put them in helicopters and or fixed-wing aircraft, and we can get them to any place in the state. They obviously got good mobility, but sometimes if we need to send a small team quickly, we can do that.
Great. And if I could just interrupt, I think that from the reaction I'm getting from other committee members, we would be interested in, if we can work it out time-wise, Mr. Borden would we'd love to.
We'd be delighted to take you through this because this is really impressive, and I think you would be make you feel pretty good about having that in our back pocket. And again, we're not first responders. But when first responders find something that they can't deal with or they're not familiar with, these people are experts in all those fields, and they've got all the equipment and all the capability to come in and assist them. Next slide is a photo of state active duty work on wildland fires. As you well know, we typically respond after the Department of Forestry has used up all of its civilian assets. And almost every summer for the last five or six summers, we've been deployed to go out and assist them. We put together fire teams that work under the direction of the Forest Service. This is part of their training they were doing as they were getting ready to be deployed onto a fire. I might add that we also, in a fire situation where the last ones that should be called and where the first ones that should be let go, one, it's a state cost, but two, we don't want to compete with private industry. The next photo is a picture of our Firehawk, which is an addition that we were able to obtain from the manufacturer who makes these things. They're about a $1.8 million asset that goes on as an attachment to the Black Hawk helicopter. We were one of the first states in the union to get this model that we fly, which is about 10 years ago now, and that was mainly due to Senator Mark Hatfield's ability to maneuver things in the Congress. This company that builds these things wanted to put this apparatus on, so we agreed to let them use one of our 15 helicopters we were getting for a year, and the quid pro quo was that we got this apparatus at the end of that year. So they gave us the free apparatus after they tested it and made sure it was flight worthy, and all the tests were done at Fort Rucker, and then they used it down in California for about 6 months, and then it came up to us, and we have had it ever since. It's a remarkable machine. The helicopter can go out, and it's got as you can see on the side of the helicopter, there's a snorkel that they can hover over a body of water, suck in 1,500 gallons of water in about, what, a minute and a half? About 1 minute and about a minute and a half of hovering, pull the snorkel back up, and then they can deliver that water. And they can deliver it in several different ways. They can deliver it either once, they can spray it, they can put it on. It's an incredible machine.
Questions, Chair.
Yes.
Do we rent our lease or have a relationship with other states who do not have one?
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, no. The way the system works is that if we need something from another state, then they will provide it if we don't have it, and vice versa. What we end up paying for, if we bring this in or they take it, is they pay for the actual hours that are used, the fuel that is used, the crews that are involved. There isn't a pro rata charge for that particular piece of equipment. Most of the other 11 helicopters that we have what we term we call it a Bambi bucket because Bambi makes it. I think that's the name of the company, but it's a small 600 gallon bucket, and they drop it in. It fills up the water just like you would a bucket in a barrel, and then they pull it out and they go deliver it. They don't have near the capability this does, obviously, because it's only 600 gallons, and they can't put it in specific spots like this thing can, and different modes. Either one fell swoop, or they can put it out in a fine spray. They've got all kinds of capabilities with this thing. We would love to have one of these for every one of our helicopters, but the reality is that's pretty expensive. So we're hoping to get the federal government to purchase more of these. So we would have them. And this is an apparatus, like I said, you can bring the helicopter in, you jack it up, you put a different set of wheels on. It takes about a day to put that thing on. It takes about a day to take it off. So it's a really capable item. Next slide is a slide of our innovative readiness training program where we take our engineer companies and our engineer soldiers, and we select projects throughout the state. This one is Mountain View High School. As you can see, these soldiers are actually doing what their military mission is, which in this case is putting down forms to pour concrete. This program has been very successful throughout the state. We primarily work at high schools or other community. We work at parks, and it requires the recipient to provide the material. We provide the manpower. Here in April, we're going to dedicate a fish hatchery that was developed by a young man up at Warrenton. Our IRT folks went in and finished the fish hatchery. He'd managed to pull the money together through different means. Senator Johnson was actively involved in getting us to participate in that. And we went over and built the thing. And this young man's ability to put all these pieces together was quite a deal. So we're going to be dedicating that in April. We're hoping the governor will be there, and I'll let you know if you have any interest in being there. Next slide demonstrates Starbase. Starbase is a program that we run in both Klamath Falls and Portland, where we have underprivileged school children in a cooperative agreement with the school district. We provide the funds through the Guard Bureau to pay for the teacher and the transportation. These kids come into a classroom that teaches science and math, and we do it on the air bases because they found that if you can relate science and math to flying airplanes and doing those things, the kids really understand it better. Our Air Guard officers and enlisted folks participate as mentors in here and explain different aspects of flying. This program's been around now for about 12 years. We've originally had it in Portland only. We expanded it down to Klamath Falls by being able to be very creative in how we did it. And we serve one class a day. The class comes one day for 6 weeks, and we have multiple classes. So teachers are hired by the school district. We tell them to hire your math and science teachers. We'll fund them. We send our buses out to pick up the kids, or we pay them to bring them into us. And then they get a chance to see these are 4th, 5th, and 6th grade kids. Next slide is a depiction of Camp Rosenbaum, which is held at Camp Rialea annually every year. This program started through the Portland Housing Authority. General Rosenbaum, who's retired, but he's a known Portland figure and was also chairman of the Housing Authority for Portland. And what he realized was the outdoor schools were simply not happening for kids, underprivileged kids. They didn't have the $5 or whatever the cost was to get into these programs. So he started a outdoor school, if you will, for 1 week out of Portland. This is completely done by donations. We have cooperation with the City of Portland Police Bureau. We have cooperation with Nike and numerous other people who provide numerous dollars and tennis shoes and shirts and everything else. And we bring the kids to Camp Rialea. Our guardsmen volunteer for that week, and they become the cooks, the mentors, the counselors, and then they have these kids get an outdoor school experience. It used to be only Portland. Now it's expanded to statewide. We take kids from statewide now because we had the resources to do that thanks to volunteerism.
General,
yes, sir.
I just had a question for you. The Starbase, is that with federal funds, general fund?
Mr. Chairman, it's all federal funds. Yeah. Well, I shouldn't say that. I suppose, though, that since their bases are 15% and 20% cost shared with state dollars, the lights and the heat of that classroom would be 15 and 25%. So the state does have a 15 and 20%. They have a small contribution. Haven't figured it out. It's pretty minimal. Whatever the lights and the heat cost for one day, six, you know. If you want the math, I can probably have somebody do it, but it's pretty minimal.
I figured it was federal.
Yeah, it's pretty much federal. The next slide shows a program that we've started over the last few years where we actually have a large environmental program inside the National Guard, and we take the environmental program folks and we go out to schools, and we try to pick several schools a year to work with Earth Day and try to explain to them and show them what we do as an institution and how we treat the environment and what our concerns and what our issues are. And I think we really try to show them the good, positive things about, you know, being good stewards of our planet. The next program, or the next slide, shows what you've seen right here in the back of the room, which is our Oregon National Guard Youth Challenge Program. This is a drill team. The Youth Challenge Program runs two programs per year. The two programs per year, we take in 150 applicants. This is volunteer. These 150 applicants volunteer to come to our program for a 22-week program. First 2 weeks are what we call pre-challenge. Some would call it boot camp. It's not boot camp. Been there, done that, and this is not boot camp, but it's close, and it has some of those elements. Typically, after that first 2 weeks, we have somewhere around 135 kids that have remained. 15, 20 of them typically choose not to be there, and they elect to leave, and we let them leave. They're not sentenced there. They're not bound by any regulator. They're completely volunteers. The remainder of the kids go 20 weeks, and basically they go to high school. We run a high school. We run a high school our way. We run a high school that, that demonstrates that you can be successful if you choose to do certain things a certain way. The kids will tell you, and you're welcome to ask any of these kids back here. You can pick any one of them you want to, and they'll be more than willing to talk to you and answer any of your questions if you so desire. These young people have an opportunity in this 22 weeks to get on course and change the way that they do business. The typical student comes in, average about 5th or 6th grade reading level, 5th or 6th grade math levels, 5th or 6th grade comprehension and science. When they leave, they typically have improved at least 1.5 grades. We give a standardized education test when they come in, and we give a the same test on their way out. During that period of time, they can earn up to 8.5 credits because we're a certified high school. We have a relationship and a partnership with Ben Lapine as an alternative school for Ben Lapine School District. This program receives ADM dollars through Ben Lapine, and they also, it's supported by the federal government and by the general fund. And those three funding sources is what makes this thing work. It's an intense operation. It's 24/7. It's not for the faint of heart, but yet I can tell you that we asked for and received a grant to do a longitudinal study 3 years ago. Longitudinal study that we completed because, frankly, we needed to know whether or not we were making this thing work or not post-graduation. And 82% of the kids that have gone through the program, and they used Oregon as one of the example, one of the test areas, are successful after they leave 3 years later. Post-graduation, there's also a one-year mentorship program. Each cadet, when they show up at our doorstep, are required to identify two mentors that are not family members, but people that they choose. We give them training. We screen them through the proper lead systems, et cetera, to make sure that we've got a good quality candidate, and then we monitor that, and we train these people on what they need to do as mentors. I can tell you without that mentor program, these kids will not be successful. You can't put them in a high-intensity program like we run, drop them off the face of the earth 22 weeks later, and expect them to be successful. It won't work. We learned that early on. Our program is unlike the other 30 programs throughout the country because the other 30 programs strive to get a GED, have these kids get a GED on their way out. Coin of the realm in Oregon, as you well know, is the diploma. We learned that early on. We made a partnership with Ben Lapine where they provide the certified teachers. We don't hire them. They're on a contract through us or through them for us. And our kids primarily reintegrate back into high school, and then they finish their high school degrees. Some of them actually get degrees while they're there, either through their high school or through us or Ben Lapine.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
You may want to comment on how you select the youth.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, our selection process is really an open process through the Internet and through anybody that wants to get on and apply. But most of our applicants come through the school counseling system. These are counselors who have seen the product, understand it, realize that it's been successful. And, again, you could probably ask any one of these young people behind me, and they would tell you they probably have a very different ways why they got there. A lot of it's word of mouth from friends that they've seen change, and they want that change. We typically get about 350 applicants. We're only able to put 150 kids into the program because of space. We just don't have the capacity. We don't have the facilities to do that. Our facility is a former DOD facility that was what we would term a black program. It was a Cold War site, and after the Cold War ended, facility was abandoned, was placed in excess, and we had an opportunity to get this program, so we thought this might be a good place for it.
I guess they left, didn't they?
Here I am offering these guys up, and they snuck out on me. They're so well-disciplined, they're so quiet that they snuck out on me. I apologize for that.
Representative Nathanson, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you give me an idea of the geography where these kids come from? Who are going through the program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, all 36 counties contribute kids to the program. I will tell you that if you look at the demographics of what we've been able to do, and I can provide that if you'd be interested, primarily we get the bulk of our kids from the Willamette Valley and the Portland area. That's the highest population area centers, and that's where we have the biggest number of kids. But they come from every county. Every county's been represented.
Thank you. If it's not, I don't want to place an undue burden on you, but if you do have the information for the last few years, I'd like to see the list of the school districts or towns where they're coming from.
Yes, ma'am. We have that. We keep that data current, and I can give you a book that thick full of data if you'd like to see it. But that is one of the items.
It's a thin book.
I'll give you one page. How's that? And we can get that for you because it is, and you'll see, you'll notice in that where you see big population counties, you have more population coming. I will tell you from having started this thing 12 years ago and looking at it today, it's interesting that some schools, when they get used to sending kids here, they really get frustrated because we've got to make it fair, but they think it's their program, and they're going to, and I'll just use one locally, McNary High School. I finally said, come on, guys. I mean, this isn't McNary High School's program. And we had a counselor out there who was particularly interested. So, so we ended up basically trying to not deny kids. That's the last thing we want to do, but we got to be fair with it as well. But generally speaking, the applicants typically come from, from the places where you'd have the population group.
Let's continue.
I think the last photo is of a graduation ceremony, and General Reese with one of our star graduates who received a scholarship and moved on to higher education. I might also add that we have been questioned before about this is a recruiting issue and your challenges, and I can assure you that it's not. The reason that I know it isn't is because if it was, it's the worst expenditures we'd ever do based on the cost. This is not a cheap program. It's about $14,500 per kid, and you wouldn't spend that kind of money to recruit anybody, I would hope. So, if you got just a second, I would love to show you the video that goes along with this program, or do you want to do that? Okay. I'll just give you a couple of seconds.
And how much of that is general fund? Did you answer that already?
The program is basically designed to be a 60-40 program. It's not 60-40 in Oregon, 60% federal, 40% state. And there's two reasons for that. Primary reason is that we hire state employees to run it. Our costs are higher than other states. And so we have an actual probably closer to 50-50, I think, would be a better view of it. When you add the ADM and the general fund, it gets closer to 50-50.
Josh Shields,
yes,
in the governor's recommended budget, it's about $1.5 million general fund, this program, and the essential budget, it's a little over $1 million general fund, $1,053,000.
Now, accredited high school between 16 to 18 years old who are considered at risk. OYCP is administered by the Oregon Military Department with support from the National Guard Bureau, Bend Lapine School District, and the Oregon Department of Education, located in Bend, Oregon, and overseen by the National Guard Bureau. The Oregon National Guard Youth Challenge Program is a last chance for many young people, a last chance at getting an education, a last chance at finding out who they are before society labels them, and a last chance to turn their life around for the better. The Oregon National Guard Youth Challenge Program is a 17-and-a-half-month commitment that can transform lives.
The Youth Challenge is a non-traditional education program, and the most important criteria that we look at is that the youngster has to be a high school dropout. This is like no other program in the nation. They, of course, cannot be on probation or parole at the time that they enter the program. They need to be an Oregon resident and a resident of the United States.
They need to understand in their own self that it's important that they change. The path they're on is not delivering what they visualize as a future. If they're willing to do that, and they're willing to admit that it's time for me to change, and I need something that's different than what I've been accustomed to, then this program will help them greatly.
Well, I was a gangbanger, and I was a lot of assaults, spray painting, you know, drugs, things like that.
Kevin had a lot of problems socializing in school, and it affected his educational part. I hope he learns a lot more responsibility. He's always been competitive, and he just needs to focus on other things.
I got in too much fights. I argued back with my parents, not my parents, but people, and I was rude.
Stevie, she wants to complete her high school, and she doesn't want to really get a GED. She wants to get a diploma.
We care about her and love her. We're not being mean to her. You know, we're just trying to guide her through it. You know, show her the right things in life so she won't go into alcoholism or drugs.
A lot of family problems caused from school, and I ended up dropping out. My grade five kids.
And he really wants this high school diploma now, and this is a one-time opportunity for him to be able to make it.
OYCP is not always easy. It's not always fun. It takes hard work and dedication, but it works. It offers opportunities for personal growth, self-improvement, and academic achievement. Since 1995, it's helped over 3,000 Oregon youth find discipline and focus while helping them discover just exactly what they're capable of. All of this starts in an intense 2-week phase of a program called Pre-Challenge.
That 2 weeks is basically used to figure out who wants to be here and who wants to stay strong and make a commitment to their lives. I've learned how to be a leader and to step out and ask questions and not be so shy.
It was hard. Teamwork is with 30 girls.
Now, the first 2 days I wasn't so sure. I did feel like I could bust it into tears like the seventh day. You know, I was just getting in trouble for everybody's actions and it didn't feel good. I learned a lot of respect. Every sentence, you know, you end with sir, yes sir, you started, yes ma'am, you messed up and you have to take big time.
Once candidates have graduated from Pre-Challenge, the real work begins. As cadets, they will begin the phase of education, training, and concerts. While at OYCP, cadets are immersed in 8 core components that make up the curriculum, the first of which is academic excellence.
We are different than a regular high school in that there is more one-on-one time. When a student struggles here and begins to fall behind, that shows up in their classroom work, and immediately we take some steps to ensure that they succeed. Working in small groups is really critical for this type of a population, but because during that small group interaction, they're building social skills. And that's something that's just a tremendous need for this population of at-risk kids.
Since OYCP is an accredited high school, cadets have a chance to earn their high school diploma. They can also choose to earn their GED or up to 8 credits that they can use to rejoin their original high school.
At Youth Challenge Oregon, we average about 1.8 grade levels per class increase. Of course, that depends on the student. Coming through the front door, you know, 60% of the kids are at about the 6th grade level in math, reading, and language. And so any progress that you make is significant. But we're after a goal of at least 2 grade levels during the period of time that they're here, over 20 weeks.
In addition to in-depth academic instruction, all cadets are put through rigorous physical fitness training while at OYCP.
Physical training is done 7 days a week. As far as confidence goes, I mean, it makes them feel like they can capture even bigger things later on in life.
I lost 71 pounds from the Youth Challenge over the physical training part, and now that I'm graduated and lost 71 pounds, I can feel like I can do anything that anybody else can do, and that's why I'm here right now. And I don't think if I didn't go to Youth Challenge program, I don't think I'd be on the football team because of my grades and because of the physical shape I was in.
I never did this much stuff in like one day. My biggest achievement is like I've been studying and turned my work in on time and not talking to class. That's what gets me. Okay. That's how I get my work done, is not talking.
The hardest task was holding my anger and releasing it in the form of writing or
just expressing myself when the time was right and the time was appropriate. These people that are so proud of me every day. My mentor, my family, my girlfriend, they all tell me how proud they are of me for doing better in my life.
The biggest challenge, I think, will be completing all my packets. They're getting harder, so I'm trying to keep up there with them.
Oregon Youth Challenge Program is designed to bring out the best qualities in each cadet. During their 20-week stay, cadets are given opportunities to be leaders.
We put them in a leadership role, especially with our platoon model, where we try to put every cadet through a leadership role, whether it be squad leader or team leader. They basically build a greater confidence. They build more assertiveness, trying to accomplish things, and basically it opens them up to approach people more.
Many graduates from OYCP will be headed into the job market once they've graduated. Job skills training and education play a crucial role in forming a complete cadet at OYCP. All cadets learn how to complete a job application, create a polished resume, and hone their interviewing skills in mock interviews. Learning to be a part of something bigger than yourself is vital to character development for OYCP cadets. Each cadet completes a minimum of 80 hours of community service. Through these opportunities, cadets have the chance to plan the work, prepare for it, and feel the accomplishment of a job well done. The Oregon National Guard Youth Challenge Program strives to make a difference in the life of each cadet. Cadets learn that they can do more than they ever thought, and that their goals are attainable.
When they graduate, they have another 12 months of mentoring. What we've learned is that when you put a young person through an intensive program like this, they must have some kind of adult role model in their lives as they transition out to help them apply the tools and build that knowledge and information that they learned while they were here. And so over the next 12 months, they will be working with a mentor on a plan that they developed that is mandatory while they were here in the program. That includes employment. It may include military. It may include college, Job Corps, or returning to their high school to seek their high school diploma. And they need somebody to work with them, and that's what they do with their mentor during the period of 12 months.
What I've learned here has definitely changed my life in many ways. I'm more close to my family, closer than I'd ever be, and my friends look up to me, and I'm kind of like an inspiration. Getting credits and I'm going back to high school to graduate in my class, and it feels good.
The Oregon Youth Challenge changed me. I have better grades. I'm healthier now, and I have my diploma. It makes me feel weird because nobody's ever been proud of me before.
I've made the honor roll, you know, 2.9 grade point average, and my old grade point average is 0.2, I think, and that's because I was always skipping school and instead of going. I've gotten mostly all the award ribbons that you can get. I'm also on the drill team. I've got the top PT out of my whole platoon. I got that every single time. I'm going back to high school. That's good.
The biggest difference is confidence, you know? And we set down goals and that he wants to achieve, and he's on the right track. Good to go.
She's more willing to learn now in school than she was. I think the one-on-one basis with the teacher and the student really helped her out, you know, because sometimes you get lost in class if you don't understand, and if there's too many, you won't ask.
Well, now that he's completed the program, he's so much more mature, more grown, have goals, and this was about. I'm very proud. I recommend a youth challenge program for any kid and any shape, any size, any color. Doesn't matter. You're all the same person when you get there. And I think anybody can do it if I can do it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's our advertisement. I think it reflects pretty well on what the program's really like. I would also mention that every one of these cadets are dropouts. They dropped out of school, so they're no longer enrolled. About 14% of them actually end up joining the military. Most of that 14% were already predestined to join the military. The recruiters have told them without a high school diploma, you can't get in, so you need to get that taken care of, and they use this as a tool to get there. So very few of them actually make the decision while they're there, but not many. Last thing I'd mention about Youth Challenge, or last two things. One is that Representative Betty Comp is one of our mentors. She took a student from last class and is mentoring her as we speak. And you might talk to her about the difficulties in being a mentor, and any of you are interested, we'd certainly sign you up. It's not an easy task. And finally, I would say that if any of you want to, or the committee as a group wants to go over there and spend some time, we would provide aviation support, probably a Black Hawk flyover, come to the program, and basically you would get the tour, you'd get to see the students and then what they do in a day-to-day life, and then you'd be able to talk to them whatever questions you may ask. So it's an open door. We have, and if you're over there on your own and not even under our supervision and want to come in and visit, you're certainly welcome. We have a complete open door policy.
I think we would be very interested. I don't know if we'll be able to do all that before session, but maybe later on, do things actually wind down in Ways and Means, or do they increase?
Well, I notice that you don't meet on Fridays. I'd certainly take your Friday up if you wanted to go.
Mr. Chair, this is such a successful program, and I would encourage members to take up the offer. And there's some of us who have been involved with this over the many, many years and would wish that we had the capacity to have, Caldwell's going to know what I'm going to say, more students and young people involved. Because if you look at the success rate, it's a very high success rate that they have, and the outcomes are very good. So just need to put in a plug for you.
Well, I appreciate that, Senator, and we're extremely proud of the program. We were just awarded, again, out of the last 5 years, we've actually been selected twice as the best overall program out of the 30 in the nation out of that 5 years. The other 3 years, we were in the top three. And each one of those 3 years, we also earned a subsequent award for one of the facets that we do well. The last one we received in Washington, D.C. here a month ago was for the most innovative program. And that had to deal with some of the difficulties we've had in getting state match money to fund our program, but we still maintained a high level of product. We've become extremely innovative. Every state in the union has been out here that has a program to find out how we do business, because even though we pay higher salaries, we have higher employee costs, we still do most, we achieve higher with less money than the other programs do. And we've just had to learn how to do that. So things like meals, our annual meal or our daily meal costs is, I forget the number, but it's, is it in here? He's going to tell me it's in here. It's extremely cheap, let's put it that way. So everybody's beating a door to our program to find out, what does it cost? How do you guys do it? And the way we did it was that we hired two cooks, and we said we're going to not contract for the typical, you know, contractors out there like everybody else does. And we do have a slide for that. Number of meals served per year is 99,456. Dining cost per cadet is $3.01 per meal, $9.03 per day. Average cost for cadet, the 29 other programs, is $4.45 a day, or $4.45 a meal, or $13.34 a day. And we were able to do that by having good cooks who can actually cook from scratch. I know that may find some people in amazement, but we found two ladies who are exceptional, and we cut our meal costs substantially. And that's a very good deal for us.
By bringing the cooks.
By hiring cooks.
To your
right.
Payroll as opposed to privatizing
it. As opposed to privatizing it. We couldn't afford those meals, and we think we get a better product, a more balanced meal, actually. So the kids will all tell you that they don't get enough to eat, and the kids that are skinny when they come in, they gain weight. Kids that are heavy when they come in, they lose weight, and they all complain they don't get enough to eat. And I think they're getting about 4,500, 5,000 calories a day, because we work them hard. So, yes, sir.
General Caldwell, do you have graduations once or twice a year, or how does
twice a year. We have a graduation in June. The class that you saw a portion of here today started in January. They'll graduate in June. We'll start another class in July, and they will graduate in December.
Okay.
So we have two graduations annually, which got us into a little bit of an interesting thing, is that under No Child Left Behind, unless you test a kid in the fall and the spring, you don't qualify. Basically, you don't meet the requirement, so therefore you get a goose egg. So there was a big article in the paper here last year when Ben Lapine reported their numbers. And of course, I saw the headline and was immediately on the phone saying, what's going on here? You know, I mean, we got good results. And they said, well, you got a problem, because the law requires you test them in the fall. When they come in, you test them in the spring, see how well they progress. And you guys aren't different kids. We had different kids in the fall, different kids in the spring. So we, if you look at No Child Left Behind, we look pretty poor. But if you look at the results that we actually have from our testing, we're looking pretty good, as you saw on the tape.
And so I think all of us would love to be invited to future graduations if you could put us.
We will absolutely do that. And again, if you've got, it takes about 90 minutes time you get on the air helicopter, and we land right at the facility. To get there, it's about a 2.5 hour, depends on how long you want to make it, 2.5 hours on the ground, 90 minutes back. So you've got about a 5-6 hour portion of the day. If you can carve out 5-6 hours of time, I can get you over there and get you back and have you a whole lot. You'll feel a lot better about yourself when you come home, I'll guarantee it, because this is really an invigorating program when you see what these kids are accomplishing. We're providing an ability or a means to do that. They're doing the work.
As long as the sergeant at arms knows where we are, they can do a long call of the house. Representative Kendler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General, I'm curious. You said that you contract out with a school district for the teachers.
Yes, sir.
Are those, if I may, just are those school teachers 100% dedicated to your program, or do they go back and forth?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, no, they work for us on that facility. They are there. They do not travel back and forth. They're dedicated to our facility and our kids.
So with a year-round program, is it the same teachers, or do you have two different sets of teachers, and how does that work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, they're the same teachers. We have we've had some changing in teachers, obviously, but they work for the whole year just like any other teacher would. Ben Lapine has, I guess the best way to term it, is a subcontractor works for them. They allow or they use to bring in certain aspects for their district for, you know, very I guess individualized kind of training, and that's who we work with is their subcontractor. They approve it. All of them are licensed by the state. All of them are certified, and we say we need teachers. This is what we need, and they provide it.
One last question: have any of those teachers actually taught in the regular public school system over there? And if so, what's their thoughts on the students' results that they're getting?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, I would tell you, they've all taught in regular school settings, and to a person, they've all told me that this is by far the best experience they've ever had. They don't do discipline. We have a cadre staff that's with every platoon. We have typically 3 male platoons, 1 female platoon. Actually, that's 2 male platoons and 1 female platoon now. Each one of them have at least 2 cadre with them constantly, except during the evenings when they're sleeping. Then we have a night staff that manages that. Those cadre are with those students the whole time. So when they come to the classroom, the cadre's in the classroom with them. Now they assist. Everybody's a teacher. Everybody in our program's a teacher, including the maintenance man. And they provide a service to that teacher, so the teacher doesn't have discipline. The teacher doesn't do discipline. There are no discipline issues. We don't allow it. So kids come to learn. And they come and they are there for a stated purpose, and the teachers will tell you that this is the best teaching environment they've ever been in, because they have no discipline issues, none. And they can actually teach, and they can actually help kids. And they have aides that also. So typically you have 25 to 30 kids in a classroom. You have a teacher and an aide and at least 1 cadre, if not 2, in there constantly with the kids. So when kids get behind, or they, like was seen on the video, when they get behind, they got a question, somebody's going to help them with that. They're not just going to be left behind. They're not going to be said, well, figure it out on your own. And we also require that every student accomplish every part of the education program. They have to get 80% on every desk. If they don't get 80%, they got to go back and redo it. So they start again. It's individualized. It's not, some of the classes are, of course, group classes, but each one of them has a packet. Each one of them has to go through each portion of that packet and move on through a certified program. So they are doing it on their own pace. So if they get behind, they can sit there on that packet and keep working and keep working and keep working. Some kids have gotten up to 11 high school credits because they received work from their former high school that they can do after they accomplish our stated program. Most kids get around 8 credits, like was said on the video. Some kids only get 5. Because if they don't get it done, they don't get a grade. We don't approve it. And they have to get 80%.
Thank you. Representative Nicholson.
I've got a money question about this. You had mentioned it's about $14,500 per student.
That's correct.
How would we compare that to the cost per child that we would see in K through 12 through the Department of Education? It's really not comparable because there are different things included in that cost. Is there a way to figure out of what that average cost per student is that we would see from Department of Education? How much of the activities, the education-related activities, are in the 14.5? Something less than that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, we can come up with that number. I would tell you that we get ADM for each child that's there per day. We get 80% of that. Ben Lapine gets 20, part of the program that the state runs with an alternative school. This is classified as an alternative school in the Department of Education. The cost, whatever that ADM cost is, I think it's around $30, $31 a day now, makes up, you recall the percentage?
Total ADM dollars?
I'm going to say it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 30% of the cost, somewhere in that neighborhood, 30 to 40%. We clearly are more, I think I've seen all kinds of numbers that run from every bit of federal monies that come in and all the other things that the typical student, but if my memory serves me correct, I read in the newspapers around $10,000 a year, I think, somewhere in that neighborhood. This is a half year, and you're at 14.5. Well, you got additional costs with 24/7 feeding, all of those things. So I think that would probably be the other part of that.
Exactly.
So it's and we don't advertise this thing as being a cheap, low cost, easy going deal. It's just simply not. We recognize that, but again, the federal government's picking up that other 50% of it, or a little better than 50%. So it makes it more palatable to the states and people like us, but it is expensive. And I can run those numbers, and I'll get them to you.
And my last question, second to last question, is that I assume there's probably don't have much private fundraising involved with that. It's state and federal.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. We have a Youth Challenge Advisory Board. You may have noticed on the tape that Senator Ben Westlin, vice chair, was actually on the stage that day because he's a member of that board. That is advisory only. The other thing that we've asked them to do is to try to raise private funds for different things. We have a foundation, or 501c3 in Central Oregon, that does do that. I would tell you that typically that thing's got $10,000 or $15,000 in it. They've done things like purchase computers when we had them go south on us. They've done other fundraising efforts to try to do things, to purchase things that we just can't. We don't have the resources to provide. So they've been good in that respect, but from a big money standpoint, Microsoft or something like that. However, all the computers you saw in there were donated by Microsoft, and that was through this 501c3. So all of our computers, initially, that's how we got them.
Right.
So there are those activities going.
Yeah, but it's not easy to raise money, and so I do understand that. But it's good that vehicle's there so that if you have particular projects, you can go out and
probably one of my biggest regrets is not being able to have somebody that would just simply go out and do that. If I could hire somebody to do that, I'd do it in the New York Minute. And we're resource constrained, and we recognize that, and we try to do it on the cheap, I guess, is the right way to say it.
And then what that person would probably do is just set up appointments for you to go out and raise the money.
Yeah, and I have nothing but time on my calendar. So,
Senator Winters.
I just like to put things in a little perspective on the cost issue, because we're talking about an alternative school approach, and we're talking about students who have dropped out of school and who are classed in some settings would be high risk. And if we really did do an accurate analysis, we would look at where they may impact our other systems. And those other systems would be where, and we know the statistics suggest that the probability that some of them would be in Hillcrest, McLaren, and our adult system. So if we look at it from a comparative cost standpoint, you have to build in those factors as well. I don't want to have on the record that we're talking about only how it compares to McKay, for example, because McKay, the students that was at McKay, wasn't successful at McKay, and so the reason that they're with you is so that you're doing an extra set of work to keep them into our school system. I just need to state that because we have individuals who are watching this tape.
I would just add, Madam, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, that it was about 8 or 9 years ago, a study was done by the Federal Department of Justice, and they concluded in this study that 80% of the high school dropouts in the United States today end up in the system. Now, they may not be in a hard bed, but they're going to be in the system taking welfare, unwanted pregnancies, and the list goes on and on and on, where we as taxpayers support that. So I guess from a cost avoidance standpoint, which is what you're talking about, if that number is accurate or even close to accurate, you only got to have about 10 or 12 of these kids, maybe 15 of them, be successful, and you've broken even if you're looking at it just strictly from a cost basis. So everything over that is profit. If you're looking at just profit and loss, if that number is right, 80%. Because if these kids don't have a high school diploma, they will not do as well in society. We all know that. I don't need to preach to you. You know it better than I do, probably. So I think from that standpoint, we feel good about it. Now, I'll go back to that longitudinal study. I'll be completely candid with you, and a lot of people didn't think I was appropriate in taking this stance, but I said we will go after that money. We will do this longitudinal study because we have to know whether or not this program is working downstream, because if it's not, we have no business being involved in it, because we're making ourselves feel good, and that's all we're doing. And 22 weeks later, these kids go out and they're right back where they started. Then why are we in business? We're no better, no worse than anybody else, and we have to know that. So there was a lot of people wringing their hands that are dedicated to the program and feel good about it, which I do too. But that number, when it came back, 82% of these kids are being not just successful. They're going on to college. They're going into the workforce. They're going into the military. They're doing something that's extremely positive, becoming tax-paying citizens and doing the right thing in life. That's a pretty good number, and I think that demonstrates that, yes, indeed, I think we are getting some good payback as a society for this kind of program. This program's not for every kid. I wouldn't sit here and tell you that. You know, it just simply isn't. And we see that when we invite 150 and graduate 110. 40 of them go home because it isn't for them. But the ones that stick it out and the ones that do complete it, actually 82% of those we know are going to be a lot better off for doing it.
That's great. And, you know, I think what we're interested in, I'm sure you are as an administrator too, is the truth.
Absolutely.
So there's nothing wrong with, in fact, OIA was here yesterday, and they made a pretty courageous statement. They said we did an evidence-based look at all the different programs that we had and found that none of them were effective. And so and that takes courage to come to the legislature and say that. And I think our job is to say, okay, that's great. We're not going to whack your budget by $1 million because your programs aren't working. We're going to allow you to come back and reconfigure.
I the last thing I'll tell you on this program, and I know we want to move on and you're getting late in the day, but we invited the Department of Education to come out and examine this program when the former Deputy Superintendent Vicki Fleming was still there. I encouraged her to not only look at ours, but look at every alternative program, and they did. It took them a while to get it all done, and I'm sure some of you remember Vicki. She's now the superintendent of the Redmond School District and doing a fantastic job. But during that study, the folks that came out didn't even know we existed. We were the last alternative high school they looked at. And they were utterly amazed at the process and the product and the openness that we provided for them to examine it. And they gave us very good marks. They said, you guys are doing the right thing. And I felt very, you know, two things have made me a believer that we are on the right track. One is that study, and the second one is that longitudinal study. And I think those two alone, in my mind, say we're doing the right thing. Can we do better? You bet. And I think that we're always striving to be better, because the thing that I don't like to see is when other programs say they're the best program out of the 30. I don't believe that. I think we are. So, and the metrics are there for you to look at, and I'd love to share them with you.
That's great. We're going to have one more question, then we're going to have to close for today.
Okay.
Had a long one, but...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to make this a comment, not a question. I want to thank Senator Winters for making those comments and reminding us that it's not just those of us in the room, but people are listening and watching. So I wanted to clarify why I asked the question I did. The cost, I'm assuming, just because of what I've heard people talk about over the past year, I'm assuming someone might pick up on that number, 14,005, and say, wow, this is expensive, but I want to be able to illustrate in a pretty simple way. We're not comparing apples to oranges. There's a lot of stuff included in that number that isn't included in the other number. I think what we'll find is actually the difference in cost is not nearly so great if you compare two numbers. And not only is it not nearly so great, it's obviously worth it if it's working. So thank you.
I would conclude that you're absolutely correct. I mean, it is not your typical high school. It just simply costs more to run it because of the way it's designed and the way it works.
All right. Well, we'll pick up again tomorrow on this. Thank you very much for coming. We apologize for being late.
No, that's quite all right. And please look at your calendars, and if there's any way that we can get a 5-hour portion of your time carved out, one or more of you, I will get you over there.
This meeting's adjourned.